Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, if you want to know where you're headed, you have to know where you are, which means you have to know where you've been. And to that end, continuing with our annual tradition, we've got the best year-end review in the business today, thanks to today's guest, Dave Collum. For those of you unfamiliar with Dave, he's professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University, my alma mater for my MBA. And in addition to his academic interests, David authors an annual macroeconomic assessment titled The Year in Review. It's hands down the best synopsis of anything that mattered during the previous 12 months. His latest year in review can once again be found in full and all its glory at peakprosperity.com. I'm excited to have him with us now live in order to expand on his excellent insights. Dave, thanks for coming back and being with us again this year.
You know, I love coming back. I like these podcasts we do. Just to for you and I to chat for an hour is for me a treat. We're somewhat like-minded. A lot of confirmation bias, but it once in a while that kind of helps you out, doesn't it?
I love a big heaping of confirmation bias. So let's get right in there, because there's, you know, how can you not have confirmation bias today though? Because you've got these broken markets, these wild things that all the central banks are trying. And now, if you look carefully, you know what I'm seeing, Dave? I'm seeing lots and lots of big banks starting to come out with their own little tentatives. Hey, this might turn out badly assessments, a little CYA report writing from some of the bigger investment houses. You've got the big giants, many of whom you collected quotes from, Paul Singer et al., saying, hey, this whole thing looks a little goofy. If you were going to give your year in review this year, if it had to have a title, what would it be this year, do you think?
Well, it actually did have to have a title. In the intro, I actually tell a little anecdote where I sent an email off to a friend of mine who your readers would all know quite well. And I said in April, I said, I'm losing track of the theme this year.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, this year's still young, dude. But there really was a deeper angst in what I was saying. And as the year went along, it didn't go away. And I became sort of less convinced that I understood what was happening. And I've never been fully convinced I knew what was going on. But, for example, last year I talked about Ukraine and the Saudis and the oil crunch and stuff like that. And I thought I had a pretty good narrative on it. And this year I had probably 25 pages of notes on the Middle East, and I pretty much punted the ball because I just couldn't figure it out. And of course, that's so central to where we're heading.
Yeah.
In terms of global terrorism. And so the title, as you know, was Scenic Vistas from Mount Stupid. Mount Stupid's a pinnacle on a curve that says your willingness to talk versus your knowledge is maxes out early. And I realized I just was losing my thread. I was losing my sense of where we are. And so that's been the theme for me this year, is disorientation.
Yeah, I was thinking of that as the subtitle, Scenic Vistas from Mount Stupid. I don't know. I would have put something like FUBAR up top, or I don't know what. This has been the craziest year ever, but I said that last year. So I've been saying this, Dave, increasingly for 6 years now, because the distortions, the deformations, the dislocations, the three big Ds, that the Fed has basically, this small politburo of appointed individuals, has taken it upon themselves to know what the best price is for everything by mispricing money itself. And they got a lot of help. The Bank of Japan's in the mix. The Bank of England's in the mix. The ECB's in the mix. Everybody's doing this. There's nowhere to go, nowhere to hide. And that creates a very chaotic landscape. But how do you even analyze something like this anymore?
I don't know. And then you got the war on cash. You got all sorts of things going on. And they're trying to shut us out of our sort of normal defense strategy. We talked about confirmation bias, and I put a little piece in there that basically said, I rely on confirmation bias. I embrace it. Now, I'm well aware that it says, you know, be careful, you might be confirming something that's wrong. But what's also true is when you were when you're feeling kind of crazy about what you're doing, you got to find some like-minded people to keep your hand on the rudder steady and to not lose sight. And so, I've been working on an exit strategy, mm-hmm. an exit from the situation we're in terms of viewing the world ever so darkly. This is by no means time to exit, in my opinion. I think we're actually topping out in the world of absurdity, but at some point we will be in a position where there will be bargains to be purchased. They eluded us in 2009 for the most part because it never got cheap. But someday there will be, and I've been trying to plan for that day when I'll be able to go back to normal investing when no one else agrees with me.
Normal investing meaning what to you? That you've got something where you can identify value and the price is okay and the prospects, the story makes sense. So there's some comprehensive story besides somebody's going to buy this from me for more money tomorrow.
Well, I that last sentence I don't like. I would rather buy a well-defined revenue stream. And if someone doesn't want to pay me for it, that's fine as long as it's a well-defined revenue stream. And but there are none of those that I like right now. I was pretty enthusiastic about energy. I knew that the credit markets were a risk for the energy market. I must confess that I didn't fully understand that risk. I'm still enthusiastic about energy, and you know the XLE is still up threefold what the S&P is from 2000. But I've had to move the goalposts back a little bit in terms of my timeline for energy. But I always want to own energy. I always want to own it. I think we need it. We'll use it. But my exit strategy ultimately is going to be hopefully to be able to do sort of a 60-40 kind of portfolio when bonds return a real return and stocks can be purchased cheap and pay good dividends and the companies have a growth going forward.
Well, we certainly agree on energy, no question about that. You and I both have some grounding in biology, so and yours in chemistry as well. So obviously, you know, all of life is just a flow of electrons and from one state to another. Energy is everything. And so as I look into this energy space, I loved what you wrote about it because it confirmed for me what I thought, which is that I really think that the initial hit to the price of oil was a political stunt, first and foremost, mainly directed at Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think it kind of got away from them once that ball got rolling. And or our political leaders are just so tone deaf that they don't really care or are unaware of the amount of damage that's being currently inflicted upon the U.S. oil industry. But at any rate, I'd love to talk to you about that because here's when I love to buy things like oil, Dave, is it's way below its marginal cost of extraction for a new barrel. You cannot possibly get it out of the ground for $38. Or 35, or where are we at today? 34. Yeah, so 34, forget about it. Not happening. You can get existing oil that you've already got a drilled well. Of course, you might lose capital because, you know, you drilled at a higher set of expectations and you're currently selling it at. That's a different story, but it can come out of the ground. Obviously, it does. Surprise to me has been how slowly the shale industry has responded to this. They're still drilling pretty steeply as well. But I know that oil has to go back up to $70, $80, $90 a barrel, or we have to admit we're going to live without oil. That ain't going to happen.
Well, I have my wish list, and I intend to buy energy equities again. I don't buy oil futures or anything like that. That's too rich for me. The one thing I do, and I think your readers ought to consider it seriously, at least the ones who are amateurs like me, is that, I try to invest in a way where if it goes badly, I forgive myself, right? And so if I bought, you know, futures and oil and started playing around in those markets and I got busted by it, I would not forgive myself because I don't understand that world very well. So I will be looking for energy equities, but I don't think they've bottomed yet. I think they're slowly responding to the price of energy, and so I'm still waiting. I'm getting restless leg syndrome a little bit, as I said, and I'm thinking about it. I want to invest in Russia too at some point, but I'm waiting for them to get their tail ends kicked bit. Maybe I'll be waiting forever. I don't know.
You mean kicked economically a little bit more, or?
And well, you know, if our markets crash, theirs aren't going to hold up, right?
Right.
And in fact, the horrifying detail going forward, I think, is in 2008-09, while the equity markets went down, the bond markets went up. And that buffered an awful lot of pensions and 401ks and endowments and things like that. And so people felt pain, but they didn't realize that there was an offsetting gain. They didn't notice that part as much. But I think the next downturn is going to be concurrent bond market collapse and equity collapse. And there will be no slack in that downturn.
And explain why you think both turned down at the same time.
I think they're both at ridiculously high levels now. I mean, the bond market can only go down, right? I mean, it could keep going up for a while, but there's just nothing left to be squeezed out of it, right? Interest rates are at 700-year lows, supposedly. I don't know how they get those numbers, but they're claimed. They're certainly at stupid lows, right? You got a third of Europe's at negative rates. So I don't see where. And I put in a quote there where some guy said, you know, if you buy bonds at negative rates, there's a chance you'll lose money. I'm going, really? You think? And so I think at some point the bond market's got to collapse. It'll start in the high yield market, right? And that's happening right now. And then it'll spread. Maybe treasuries will get bid to the stratosphere. But at some point, you got to get a real return. And so the bonds have to sell off to get back to that real return. So they got to go. And then all crises are credit crises, right? And then equities are going to go once there's not leverage out there for share buybacks and stuff like that.
Well, think about, you know, my model for this is, remember, I can't remember, geez, I'm drawing a blank on the year, but Bernanke was still in charge and it was the so-called taper tantrum. I remember the month, not the year, it was June, and everything sold off. Everything just got clubbed at once, everything. That's sort of my model. Remember, that was like 2 or 3 days of awkwardness. Bonds were down. Commodities were down, stocks were down, everything was just getting sold all at once.
Too many years ago. In there, you know, there's the fear of 25 basis points. And to me, it's, at first I thought it was just an abstract fear in which people would say, yes, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. And we know what icebergs do, right? But Zero Hedge did an interesting analysis and said, look, you raise 25 basis points, you are going to see the equivalent of a quantitative tightening of $800 billion. And I can't say I follow the line completely, but I thought it was a credible storyline. So if they start raising rates and they start unwinding these incredibly leveraged positions, there's a problem, right?
Well, there is. Of course, the Fed has a few other tools besides just taking liquidity out. They can raise the rate of interest they're paying on the excess reserves, and that would serve as sort of a magnetic attractor to a higher rate without withdrawing any liquidity. In fact, it's actually liquidity additive because you're paying banks more for the privilege of giving them free money that they round trip back into an account that you pay interest on. So they could do that. There's a variety of things they could do because we know the Fed's deathly afraid of this market going down, and they know they don't want to withdraw a lot of liquidity. So I think they've been doing, you know, what they can, and they got apparently the rate hike they wanted, only withdrawing, I think, about $130 billion so far that I've seen. So they got away with doing it with a lot less than that, you know, Zero Hedge estimate that came through some firm, I can't remember who. But looking at that, you know, here's the theme I see. I see all the central banks as just being really afraid of the markets they've created. And I don't remember you really writing about sort of the psychology of what's going on in the Politburo or the FOMC or inside the halls of those power bases. But it seems to me, from everybody I talk to, that the Fed is actually pretty clueless. They don't really have a good plan. They didn't really mean to end up here. And they don't really know how to get out of here. But as you wrote in your article, you summed it up, you said that the dominant narrative, the theme this time that everybody's running with, like we had railroads as a theme once that supported a set of bubbles, we had internet, at least that was a credible story you could hang a hat on and say, yeah, I get how the internet's going to change everything. Let's just go crazy on a bubble. But this bubble is a bubble of faith in a bunch of people who are appointed committee members, just a small handful of them. And that seems a little dangerous.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're afraid or if they're clueless. You use both, and so you kind of hedge your bets there.
Yeah.
I think it's probably a combination. I know Bernanke was afraid of 1938. I had a sort of an epiphany on 1938. You know, so everyone seems to accept the notion that in 38 the Fed tapped the brakes at the wrong time. After a discussion I had with Mark Spitznagel, which was quite a treat, and he mentioned the Tobin's Q, and I started thinking about it some more. That's a valuation model that's really sort of a price-to-book valuation model, and he wildly endorses it as the cleanest of all the valuation models. And I went back and looked at it that night and was staring at it, and I noticed that in 1938, according to Tobin's Q, the Fed had blown another bubble. And I had never noticed that before. So the Fed, the Tobin's Q, had reached all-time highs again. And so the Fed had to tap the brakes in 38 because they had overjuiced the markets.
So price to book, is this, how clean is the book? You know, we've got all kinds of shenanigans going on in accounting these days. So is there a cleaned up Tobin's Q, or is that slowly been drifting off into nebulous uselessness like a lot of statistics?
Well, let's assume it's clean. It's at near record highs with the exception of 2000. But it's above 29, it's above 67, it's above the obvious high points. And if it's not clean, then it's worse.
Right.
So, you know, I don't need to know. I know, this is like the inflation debate. I no longer need to know how wrong it is at this point because I'm not touching it. And I talked to some guy who said, don't be careful of Tobin's Q. And I go, well, I'll start worrying about the validity of Tobin's Q when it's below the mean. Then I'll start worrying about whether we're getting a valid read on it.
Right.
Right now, it can be wrong. I don't care. I'm not buying. That's the key.
So price to book then. Book meaning, for those who are not totally familiar with accounting, this is the book value of a company, meaning what we've done is we've added up all their assets that we know about and subtracted out their liabilities and say, hey, there's an enterprise value here that if you just broke this company up today, what would it be worth? Of course, this is a little bit tricky to estimate sometimes because Coca-Cola, how much is the brand itself worth? There's a way of valuing that. So I'm not familiar with exactly how all that would get wrapped into the Tobin's Q because I'm not that familiar with it. But the idea here is that the amount that people are paying for companies as in terms of their book value is the second most extreme in all of history, right? It's second only to what, 2000?
Yeah. And what's also true is there's a bunch of other valuation models. The one that just should be very wary of its price earnings ratios.
Right.
That's the one that's toxically wrong. But there's a bunch of others like Buffett's is price to GDP. And the problem is the GDP is now all contorted. But again, assuming it's clean, which is the best case scenario, Buffett's indicator valuation is about 40% above the mean. As I said in the write-up, I said, you not only regress to it, you got to regress through it because you got to spend half your time on each side of the mean pretty much.
Good point.
That's my freshman math teaching me that one.
Yeah, good point. Now, this has been, of course, a very frustrating period of time for people who use history, who use common sense, who use fundamentals, who use valuations, things like that. I'm thinking of Hussman, great guy, one of the smartest and most astute and mathematically oriented market mavens I'm aware of out there, and it's just tough sledding whenever I talk to him, and it's been hard for a while, and so as you and I were talking about, I think before we started recording, here's my frustration with all of this, Dave, and I do the same thing, not nearly as comprehensively as you do all at once, but what I do when I'm writing is I start collecting dots and I put them all together, and once I put them in one spot, I'm like, my first reaction is, you have got to be kidding me. How can we be tolerating this? But we do, and my frustration is that a lot of people still don't get just how weird and extended things are. The Fed plays dumb or coy or both, and what I'm worried about is that when this finally does really break, I have the same fear that I think the Fed does. Once this really, the ball gets rolling on this, I think this does go through the mean, and I think it's much worse than 2008. I think the damage is going to be extraordinary, and I'm really worried about how my country is going to respond to that, because I don't think we're going to take it well. My personal projection is that my country will blame somebody, maybe Islamic people or Russians or Chinese, doesn't matter, right? Yeah. That's what I feel.
Yeah, yeah, they do it every time. The good news is there's very few countries left to bomb. we're already bombing most of them. Here's my fear. One of the parameters in market corrections that is grossly underestimated is time. And I really try to eliminate time from my portfolio, so I would never buy an option with an expiration date. And if you make the right bet, you want to be able to stay there until it's either the wrong bet or it pays. And the problem with bear markets and secular bear markets, which I argue we are still in, there's a lot of bulls saying I'm an idiot, but I argue we're still in a secular bear market. I'm waiting for the third leg down. I'm a big fan of the three leg down model. Mm-hmm. Is time is the killer. So if you're a Japanese investor in the Nikkei in 89, 25 years later, you're not only down, 70%, you also have given up half of your entire investing life waiting for something good to happen. And if you're an investor in 67, in 1981, 14 years later, you are even on capital gains, but you're down 80% on inflation, and you have burned 14 years of your investment life again. So my fear is that they're somehow going to be able to stall this so long that you and I are just going to sit there and we're just going to, dead cold fingers sitting on the mouse waiting to click. Yeah. And if they don't wash it out pretty soon, time will start to chip away on all of us.
Well, it has been chipping away, and of course I'm thankful. Oh my God, I'm praying right now. I am thankful that I'm not a pension fund. Who those guys and gals just been getting cleaned. Can you imagine being responsible for the retirements of millions of people potentially, and you need 7.75%? In this particular environment, I don't even know where I would begin. I'm very frustrated at my own portfolio returns, but I can't even imagine how bad I'd feel if I was responsible for thousands, maybe millions of people.
Well, if you integrate your, I know what you've done through the years. If you integrate your returns over the last 15 years, I bet you beat the S&P.
Oh, I did, yes.
Right, as did I. Now, for the last 5 years, you and I have been getting browbeaten by the bulls. But you have to integrate over a long period. So we had a huge lead on them in 2009. We were just rocking at that point. And we've given up some of that lead, but we still got a comfortable margin, a factor of two or three for me, relative to the 09 crowd who somehow smart enough jumped in, although I don't think many did actually. I don't know. Hopefully this will eventually equilibrate and eventually cause the carnage that's necessary. The 7.5 to 8% return crowd, that gets back to the bond market. If the bond market returns zero, which it's priced to return zero or worse, right? Mm-hmm. It's priced to pay you nothing in dividends and hold up or to collapse. And if that pays nothing, and I got to do sort of back the envelope in my head, 60-40 portfolio, you get nothing out of the 40. You're going to have to get about 12% on the 60. And I don't think equities from this level could possibly give you reproducibly 12% a year. I don't think it's even theoretically possible, unless, of course, inflation's above 12%.
Yeah. So on that front, people vary a little bit on where inflation really is. But obviously it's so I don't really go by prices as much as I do looking at credit and money and watching the collapse in M2 velocity and looking at the fact that the Fed did get some credit out the door. But boy, we must be scraping the bottom of the barrel. We have all I think the last person who wanted to took out a tuition loan for an online university. And I think the last person who could buy a 84-month subprime auto loan has been found and rounded up and given a loan. It really feels like I don't know how much further we go. Can people really continue to extend the housing market in San Francisco? The signs say maybe not. We see a lot of things that look like topping signs here. So where is the story that says, here's where we're going to get this inflation the Fed keeps yapping about? Where does that come from? Except a war that accidentally causes oil prices to spike, which isn't the inflation they need. They need monetary inflation, not necessarily price inflation. One's a symptom, the other is the cause.
Well, I'm not... Okay, so hat tip, a number of years ago, there were a half a dozen deflationists on the planet, best I can tell. I happen to have realized I should have given Mish Shedlock a hat tip for, he was a diehard deflationist, and I thought he was nuts, and other people thought he was nuts, and he's looking pretty smart right now. I think we're going to have a hybrid model here where I think we're going to get the worst of both scenarios, where we're going to get inflating prices and deflating assets. And I don't know what to call that. For years, I've been railing on the idea that something so complicated as zillions of prices moving around could possibly be described in a binary language of inflation or deflation. That just strikes me as nuts. So I think we're going to have price of veal and beef going up and the price of your equities going down and the price of bonds going down and possibly the price of houses going down again. And I think we're going to end up with a credit crisis because while energy high yield bonds start continue to tank, liquidations from the funds start, you're going to start having to sell the ones that aren't tanking. And so other high yield bonds that are maybe weren't such a crazy idea will now get crushed. And then lesser risk bonds will start to get sold from portfolios and it just cascades. So I think we'll have an inflation-deflation hybrid combo, all the bad things rolled into one. I know it sounds like a doomsday scenario. But my exit strategy is I think the next recession is going to be a barn burner. And at the point where everyone is talking about the recession, I intend to start averaging in. And if Tobin's Q's at the mean, I will start there. And last time I did, but then it jumped. And I will start averaging in, and hopefully I'll average all the way down to stupidly low levels of Tobin's Q and wish I hadn't done it. Mm-hmm. But I really would love to get to 60-40. I would like to get back there, but I'm not doing it until it's a bargain.
Well, this is going to call for more patience, right? So a lot of patience so far. I'm running out of patience. I have to admit, you say you have restless leg syndrome. I have frustrated eyebrow syndrome. I just keep squinting at my screens going, how are we still here? How is this still this dumb? Now, what I'd love to get your take on, because you and I both have the opportunity from time to time to rub email elbows with or even face-to-face, some of the big money names out there who are in this. And I'll tell you, Dave, so, I've been at a few major sort of heavy duty wealth conferences, both presenting and attending. And when I talk to these people who are running these big giant funds, they're nervous. They're nervous. I was talking to the guy who has a giant real estate portfolio, unloading it as fast as he can. It's in New York City. I asked him why. He said, our metric is once we see around 7,000 to 10,000 units with a minimum square foot price of $3,000 a square foot, we just start running away from this as fast as we can. 3,000 a square foot, right? That's like at the low end. They have apartments there that are going for $4,000, $4,500, $5,000 a square foot. The people who are managing the assets complain that there's really nowhere to look at this point in time. No, not within sectors and not across the globe. Nobody can find price. Nobody can find value. Everybody's concerned that they're overpaying. And here's the fun part. Everybody thinks they're a little closer to the exit than the next guy. And we'll be able to protect their clients in the next downdraft. What are your thoughts there?
They're nuts. I think the reason the third leg down model works is because everyone knows when it starts. I think the fear of not again, it gets so compelling, so overwhelming. I believe that when the secular bear market's over, people will swear off asset classes in their entirety. And they'll say, I'm just never, ever, ever again going to buy that. That's just a piece of garbage, and I'm not buying it. I've been duped three times. And last night, I had one of my business school colleagues tell me to buy real estate, commercial real estate. And she said, oh, that's been a really great investment. I'm going, yeah, okay. I'll put that on my wish list. I'll buy some that has boards on the windows. The reach for yield is going to kill people. Is they sold 100-year Mexican junk bonds. I mean, Mexican junk bond is redundant in my opinion, but they sold 100-year bonds in Mexico, and Nestle got negative interest rate bonds, a corporate bond that's a negative rate. This is certifiably nuts, and it will just drive us nuts. Then one day it'll crack. And the ice under our feet, you'll hear it crack, and you go, that was it. And I remember when it did it in 07, and I know you and I were waiting for it and waiting for it, and it finally did in 07 when you heard a crack, and the internal Bear Stearns hedge funds went down, and they were supposedly little things, and you go, no, something's going on in there, and Tanta, that woman writing from inside the system, and we'll hear that again, I think. I think we'll get that, and we kind of got it in August, right? The market started to break. They started to dysfunction in August, and then somehow they pulled off a stick save. I don't know how they did it, but guys like Eric Hunsader said he could see the markets breaking. There was to complete air pockets, malfunctions, everything was wrong, and we'll do that. They saved it, but you can only save these things so many times before one gets by you. It's like a hockey goalie.
Yeah, and so in terms of how they saved that one, now, there were a couple there that was an August and also an October save. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I don't know. I really have not a clue how they saved it in August. They couldn't drop rates. I didn't see any evidence of huge influxes, although maybe I'm forgetting that Draghi dumped some money in or something. They somehow have the psychology. They have the leveraged speculators not willing to run for the exits yet. They were able to head that off in the past. The fact that the system is 50% more leveraged than it was in 07 is just so staggering. And you've shown charts of the little blip and the leverage and the damage it did and how it's just gone exponential since then. And
right.
This is one of these Dave and Chris get together and lament how crazy the world is moments. At some point when it finally is true and we're shown to be correct, it's not going to be satisfying. We're not going to be sitting there, partying and party hats and noisemakers because it's also going to be a bloodbath. It's there's going to be a lot of human suffering when this finally lets go, I think.
Well, indeed there will, of course, and I think that's what everybody's a little bit afraid of. What are you detecting though in your communications with people who are talking with you who you consider to be well connected, plugged into markets, market rhythms, all of that? Are you except for your colleague who very helpfully has said buy commercial real estate, and I think your colleague may want to check out what Sam Zell is doing right now. He's obviously been through a few cycles. He's unloading his commercial real estate as fast as he knows how.
He's doing it again?
Yep.
Because he called the top at the last one, right? He sold his entire empire in 07.
Yep.
And that was the bell, right? That was ding, ding, ding. That was it. It seemed like people knew it, too. When Sam Zell emptied his empire, you go, wow, that's a top call.
And I think if I remember right, he sold off like almost $40 billion of it to BlackRock. So he really...
$30 billion. Yeah. So who do I talk to? So, I chat all the time with some guys who are pretty smart and they're getting crushed. So if you look at someone like David Einhorn, he's down, last count I saw was 21%. I know he's frustrated. Both his longs and his shorts are going against him, right? And when guys who are that smart are losing money, the market, what it means is the winners are the dumb guys. And I think in the past, I was talking about the dumb money being the retail guys. And so that, leverage speculators are unloading on the dumb guys at the end, and they call it distribution. And it's, they talk about shearing the sheep. I don't think that's going to happen this time. The retail guys are not buying these assets up. And the leverage speculators are just going to have to unwind them to each other. And that's not going to happen. And so I think, you know, you got risk parity funds. The bond market, that's what you want to pay attention to. Guys like Ray Dalio says, you know, the way you make money off bonds is you lever them up to the point where you can sort of lever up and get the same returns as equities and the same risk as equities, which I don't think you need to lever to get that. but he does 3 or 4 fold leveraging of a bond fund. And when it starts unwinding, those risk parity bond funds are going to unwind so quickly. They're going to be margin called from desks. And as I said in my year in review, you know, Ray Dalio's Bridgewater might become a bank on some Sunday night, right?
Well, this is, you know, obviously we're seeing, it's a big story. I don't really recall seeing a lot about this lately, but I think just, you know, as recently as midsummer, there were a lot of articles talking about the complete lack of liquidity in bond markets, and not just the treasury markets and the other ones that are completely owned by the central banks at this point, like the bank, you know, the Japanese government bond market by the Bank of Japan. But the corporate bond markets, too, very, very, very low liquidity. And so we just saw that all sort of come to a head with the gating of that junk bond fund and then the closure of another and then another. You know, so the junk bonds clearly have been tiptoeing out the back door since about June. They started thundering out the front door starting about a month, month and a half ago. And still a lot of complacency, I feel. People look at that, and I got to tell you, Dave, that's kind of the same warning signs that I saw in 2007, well before we started to see anything really go off the rails in 2008.
Well, you know, you may be able to help me here. The word liquidity has multiple meanings to me, best I can tell. And some of them are intractable to me. So the simplest of all, of course, is the idea that an asset is liquid if you can get out of it without altering its price much, right? So, you know, if you have $1 million worth of Microsoft, you can sell it. That's a highly liquid stock. If you have $1 million worth of a local bank stock that's a penny stock, you can't sell it. And so that one's very illiquid. So I get that liquidity. And in the bond market, you can have liquidities like that where it's just, they call it a buyer strike, right? Where you go to sell and people say, no, I'm not buying. And during the crisis in 07, 08, 09, I was at a conference and one of Yale's mortgage gurus, and I say that with tongue in cheek, but he thinks he is. He said, I don't know why they didn't just reprice the mortgage-backed securities. I said, well, because A, no one knew what was in them. And B, it happened too fast, so I'm just stepped to the sidelines and said, I'm not buying anything right now, and therefore they became illiquid, right? That's liquidity. But then you get the liquidity in the repo market, and this notion that that the whole money system relies on having collateral of a certain quality, and as the central banks are buying up that quality collateral themselves, then the banking system is missing that. Do you understand that better than me? Because it wouldn't take much.
Well, there's those pieces, which I think you did a great job explaining. And then there's just the idea of liquidity in terms of movement. So to me, an illiquid issue is, I was reading about this guy who owns a bond fund, and he put up a corporate issue for sale. And there was a whole bid-ask stack there, apparently, but he put the issue up, and that a day later it was still sitting there, right? It that means that there was... He spent 24 hours just trying to get rid of one CUSIP from one issue, and that it just didn't go anywhere. So when we say there's no liquidity, it means the depth and the breadth of the trades are very, very low, right? And then you're talking about a quality liquidity as well. Like there's, you know, once you have like this atrocious quality stuff, there might be a lot of it, and a lot of it's changing hands. But that's the kind of stuff when the worm turns, it often just freezes. Nobody wants to bid for it at all because nobody knows what it's worth at that point. Because the value of something, at least in part, is due to the fact that you still can sell it to somebody. As soon as you can't sell it to anybody easily, its value now suddenly might be defined by something terrifying like its actual intrinsic value.
Yeah, and then you reach a point where the funds, so they start throwing away the rule book. And they start, even though the funds might not have any lockout mechanism, they basically just turned a blind eye in what you used to think of as infinitely liquid funds, where you could just pull your money out whenever you want, they seize up and they stop letting you withdraw your money. And so there's a liquidity problem there. But let's say you have some sort of money market fund, which is critically dependent on having JGBs from Japan as collateral, and then the Bank of Japan buys every JGB on you. So then the question is, how does your fund function if by law, by mandate, you need them and they don't exist, right? And so I think that's another, I think that also gets the name liquidity. It's all part of that whole repo thing. I would be a liar if I told you I understood the repo, reverse repo market. I've spent a lot of energy trying to understand it, and it still baffles me. I'm not stupid, right?
Yeah, well,
but I'm actually on the other side.
So it is baffling, of course, and nobody understands at all how the derivative market works. I'm comfortable saying that. I've talked to a lot of people who write derivatives, who are intimate with them, can really explain. You know, derivative isn't a thing. It's not like, you know, I decided to sell you a flashlight, and we could both agree it's a flashlight. It's a derivative is a contract. It's 20 to 40 to 100 pages, depending on how dense your lawyers wanted to get with it. So these derivatives, they're just big, giant paper contracts. And of course, any contract can be a little dense, but these will refer to what the parties, the counterparties, and other related derivative contracts. And if this happens, then it'll be priced this way and that. And it's just, they're very complex. And, you know, I do remember, you know, where I formed a lot of my opinions about this was when I think it was General Ray. And this reinsurer had 14,000 plus derivative contracts on the books. And he started unwinding those, and it took them years, and they never could figure out what they were worth. And this was just 14,000 of these contracts. There's millions of them outstanding in just, you know, an individual firm like J.P. Morgan. And that was where he developed his idea that they are weapons of mass destruction, financial weapons of mass destruction. So then we saw Greece go belly up and default back a number of years ago. And the ruling body for derivatives said, oh, yeah, it's not really technically a default. We know they missed their coupon payment and other things you would say is a default moment, but we're not going to call it a default. And it took them months to declare that a default because behind back doors, they had to figure out how they were going to settle the market for what turned out to be $78 billion notional outstanding with only $3.8 billion at risk, of which $1.8 billion ultimately ended up changing hands. It took them months to figure out how they were going to settle that $1.8 billion bet, billion with a B. These things number in, you know, potentially the value at risk in a fast moving interest rate environment could be in the trillions of dollars. Could be, right?
The thing to remember also, that a great example of what you're describing also is counterparty risk, where you may be owed money, but if you're owed money by some guy who's wearing a barrel with two straps, you're not going to get paid. Was back in the mortgage crisis that the mortgage-backed securities were basically insured credit default swaps by a bunch of leverage hedge funds, right? So your insurance company had no assets. They had no collateral. They had, unlike, you know, regulated insurance companies that supposedly have big, huge wads of stuff they can use to pay out when they need to, when the credit default swaps are held by leverage hedge funds, you're not going to get paid. And so all of a sudden you think you're hedged. I remember when Citigroup says, don't worry, we're hedged. I'm going, hedged by whom? Who can hedge Citigroup? Right? And so, yeah, these derivatives are a mess. I think Buffett got duped. I mean, he admitted it. But he still screws around in that market. That little old man's like the mafia guy, you know. And he's not as much of a country boy as he likes to pretend.
You don't think so, huh?
No, I do not think so.
So I don't know how much time you spent writing this fabulous year-end review. I'm sure it's quite a bit, and you know, you have hundreds of citations, and when you put it all in one spot, is your faith in humanity bolstered or crushed? What happens?
It's an interesting. Well, let me first make a couple of comments about the writing of it. I have people say, how do you do it? How do you find time? Questions like that. Sometimes it's you know, just out of curiosity. Sometimes it's critical, believe it or not. The way I do the thing is I collect all the information and I read with a purpose. The reason I do it is it makes me read what I'm reading with an idea that at the end there's got to be a narrative, right? So I read with the idea of finding themes. I get to around the 1st of November, And I have about 400 to 500 pages of quotes, links, comments, you know, excerpts in a Word file that are randomly distributed. They're not sorted at all. And then I sort them, and then I write the sections. And it takes me about 30 days at night, maybe 3 or 4 hours a night writing to write the thing. And you know, William F. Buckley used to write a book in 160 hours first draft. So I try to be inspired by that idea. And you know, I got 18 hours in a day, and if I put in 14 or 15 into my full-time job and then another 4 into this, I'm okay. I'll live with that. And that's just to my critics, you know, at some level they can kind of take a hike for all I care, but if they want to know how I do it, that's how I do it. That's my hobby. That's they go do wine tasting. I write. And then at the very end, I find the themes. This year, what made it so hard is the themes were elusive to me this year at some level. Greece was a great theme, right? Weren't we told all year long that Greece was going to destroy the world, and then they voted a referendum that looked like it would destroy the euro system, and then all of a sudden, not only did it not destroy it, but the whole storyline disappeared?
Oh, I love disappearing storylines. You want to know the other big one that just disappeared, and I couldn't believe it, was the Ashley Madison hack. there were a lot of unfortunate names on that list. Wasn't that amazing that the media somehow forgot to troll through all of that and find all of those names from the people at State Department and elsewhere? I mean, it was that to me was one of the greatest disappearing acts of 2015.
Well, the other thing I try to do is I collect these little snippets through the year that are just human interest stories. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this. The FBI came out and admitted that 95% of their forensic hair and particle analyses that were used to convict people for decades is wrong. Now, someone explained to me why that didn't turn into a colossal scandal. There's guys who've been executed on FBI forensic evidence, and the FBI admitted it was wrong. 95%, right? And these stories go right by half, three quarters, 90% of the people. So I try to grab those stories too. You know, I know it's long. I don't have time to write a short one. But if you read it, and if you really do read it, there's an awful lot of meat on the bones in there. It's really a year of human folly all brought together, and I try to stitch it. I try to stitch it together in a way that makes a plot line. And I try to be a wise ass. By the way, at the end, I hammer Hillary. I know there's Hillary fans. If you read as much about Hillary as I have, you would realize that she should be in prison and she's a sociopath. And anyone who votes for Hillary, in my opinion, if they knew what I knew and still voted for Hillary because she's a woman, you are selling your soul, in my opinion. You only get one and you sold it if you vote for her. Everyone says, oh, the politicians are all crooked. No. Hillary has her own zip code in that category.
You want to know, it doesn't take much to, I don't do politics at all, but she completely lost me forever when I saw her on TV, knowing she was being filmed, laughing about the execution of Muammar Gaddafi, who, whether you like him or love him or hate him or all that, if once you read about what Muammar actually did for his country, yes, he was a strong man, but you kind of have to be one in the region, but his people had the highest standard of living in all of Africa. And somehow that offended us greatly. And so NATO took him out. And so she got on live TV and laughed and said, we came, we saw, he died. Right? Somebody who can do that loses me on the human level. I don't care if you're a woman or a man or whatever. She lost me as a human really badly at that point in time.
Yeah. And then the other place I go pretty dark is campus life at the very end. I had Adam read it pretty carefully, and he took out a chunk, which I really liked, but he took out. But what's going on campuses these days is pretty strange. You know, the Yale-Mizzou story is only part of it, and I get into it. I actually place myself some level at job risk. I don't actually think so. I'm a tenured 60-year-old professor, department chair. It'd be hard to get me, but and a pretty good record of publishing and fundraising and you name it, service. But when I write that stuff in this climate, I certainly could draw fire, but I decided to step out because I happen to mention this in it, that I know a kid I think is rotting in prison on a false sexual misconduct conviction. And it kind of tipped me over the edge. And so I've been on a campaign to help him. And so I've got an Atlantic Monthly journalist who's going to write about it. And she said the case is appalling. And he got convicted of political correctness, in my opinion. I think this epidemic of political correctness on campuses is toxic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I was just at a holiday party, and there's a young gentleman, and he's now 18 at a major university. And I've known him his whole life. So very close to him. And so I was asking him about his freshman year, and he said, oh my God, one of his stories, he said, the PC thing is so intense that he and his friends get together and they have these hazard stories where they're all afraid to have any interaction with women. And none of his friends will even remotely talk to a woman who might be even slightly drunk, because they know the hazard stories are passing around is that they could end up in prison if anything goes wrong, and even a week later she decides to remember this thing differently. Like this is a legitimate hazard story for young men now, is that they may well be charged with something that doesn't necessarily have the same burden of proof, or I'm sure you're more familiar with this than all of that, but that certainly wasn't a I grew up with a different set of concerns and fears, but it was interesting that for him, a dominant theme of his experience was having to watch what he said and did very carefully, knowing it was being put under a lens that was a moving target, is how he described it.
And by the way, this is not so, if you know, related to police brutality. You know, there's bazillions of policemen out there, and there's some really striking videos, but the rational person could say, yes, but that we're selecting spectacular cases. And as a consequence, you know, it's not anywhere near as rampant as we're being told. This actually is a pretty rampant problem. So if I had a son in college, I'd be very scared, because the way it works now is if your son has sex with a young damsel consensually and they are somewhat intoxicated, which, you know, I don't know many people went through college who didn't fit that description a few times. She can turn around and charge him with sexual misconduct, and that guy just got thrown into the system, and he's not coming out undamaged. And it's that striking. He could get a signed affidavit from her saying, I want to have sex, and she can still turn around and turn him into a wretched soul fast. And this is not because of the kids. This is because of the adults in the system who have totally lost their way. And so I've attempted to fix it here. I mean, I actually have expressed my concerns to our dean and provost saying, you have got to do better than this. And I think our president has spoken out against the idea of this hypersensitivity. But it's very dangerous. And I'll tell you, if you get charged with sexual misconduct on a campus, I don't think the courts can possibly go there. In fact, the courts are overturning these decisions fast. But if you get kicked off a campus for sexual misconduct, good luck getting the job, right? You just spent $200,000 to get a job, and you're not going to get one.
Well, let's go further then. That this idea of this correctness that's pervading, I guess, all levels of thought. And I've seen, I know you wrote about it, but this idea that there are ideas that are too dangerous to discuss. It's like the Lord Voldemort idea, you know, the ideas that shall not be named, right? I thought that an important part of my collegiate career was getting my mind expanded. And that was important to me. I had a, you know, pretty standard liberal arts education, but I was exposed to things that frankly were unusual and new to me, and I thought that was a good part of the process. Is it really to the point now, in your estimation, where are the minds as closed as they seem from the outside? Because I only get the news, right? I peer in from the outside, but it looks pretty atrocious to me sometimes just how virulently narrow-minded some of the arguments are.
Yes, yes and no. Here's the funny part. I think most of the campus is proceeding along paying no attention. But and so, for example, if you look at Yale and you look at all the press it got, my guess is that there was a little pocket of kids who were screaming and the press was surrounding them, and it looked like all of Yale was going bananas when in fact it was just a small pocket of kids who were going bananas. So in some sense, campus life is just moving forward. On the other hand, any kid on this campus is at risk of that disaster. And I was talking to a kid who's editor in chief of an online newspaper that pushes back against these things. And he actually said that there's about 10 virulent activists representing all the different causes total, and that they all hang out together and they all support each other's causes and they organize the campaigns. So it's quite possible that the campuses are being disrupted by a pretty tiny minority of students. I don't know what's this true. I'm guessing, for example, in Missouri, I'm guessing the race problems are worse than at Yale. That would be my guess, just because of the region of the country. Mm-hmm. It's pretty mind-boggling. But my biggest fear is the sexual misconduct. I'm sure my kids can avoid being racist. I am not confident they can avoid having sex with drunk women. Unfortunately, they're out of college now. I don't know what I would tell an entering freshman male to do. Besides, you could be in a world of trouble. And you could go abstinence, I guess. Probably some people think that's great, but that usually doesn't work, right?
Well, so it raises I've been doing this whole hazard story thing with my own kids too. My eldest, she's 21, and then I have a 17-year-old boy, 15-year-old girl. And when all of this police brutality stuff started really coming out, it's pretty obvious to me that there's a real problem, just a giant epidemic, and that even anything other than complete, immediate, and full compliance, no matter how outrageous or how illegal or how against your rights. Like, I didn't even bother teaching my kids their rights. There's no such thing as rights at this point in our country, because even if your rights get violated, your only recourse is to sue the police in a civil matter. And if it's really, really egregious, maybe the Justice Department will come in and whitewash the whole thing for you later. But it seems to me that this idea that we have rights, that all got really just atrociously eroded. And I'm wondering, where did that really come? I have to say, I think a lot of things went badly off the rails in our country's response to 9/11. And it's going to take a long time to work that out of our system, if ever.
Yeah, certainly the Patriot Act, things happened since then. A huge issue, which again I talked about a little this year, a lot more I think last year, is civil asset forfeiture. Yep. A lot of people don't know this. You can be driving down the road, they pull you over. If you happen to have stuff of value in your car, they can confiscate it. You say, no, that can't happen. Yes, in fact, it's estimated that $2.5 billion has been confiscated without a charge affiliated. And the vested interest is that 80% gets to go straight to fund the police department that confiscates it. And so there are notorious stretches of highways and places where you don't drive down that highway with anything of value in your car. There's videotapes of prosecutors talking about how to maximize your asset forfeiture. Seizure from and the guy, one of these guys, sort of is slobbering over the idea of getting a Mercedes from a guy, and then they blew it and they missed the Mercedes, and here's what they did wrong, right? Stunning stuff. Bloomberg wrote about it and said that and the success rate of getting your assets back is very low. And a problem I have is if they do it to me, my sense of vengeance would be so high that I would become blood of patriots pretty fast, I think. And I don't want to go there. But if someone stole my money, I don't know how I would contain my anger.
Yeah.
And I would have no, there would be no morality left in my response. I would, the constraint would be fear of reprisal, and that's it. And I don't know why more things like this don't happen, right? You don't have to be a medicated young teen to go nuts, right? And so I just pray no one seizes my assets, because I swear to God, for your sake and for the rest of society's sake, I'm going to try to find a way to rectify that injustice.
Yeah, your dial settings include mild-mannered college professor, and then there's one more click of the dial, and you go straight, straight to vengeance.
And people should, in my opinion. I don't know what the appropriate response is, but I do know the appropriate response is not to roll over. Right. That's not the appropriate response, right? Now, rolling over is, you're, I owe it we owe it. Did you ever read the Robert Dorner Manifesto, the L.A. cop who wrote a manifesto before declaring war on the LAPD?
Did he write on the militarization?
Yeah, he wrote about the corruption LAPD, and then he ended up in a shootout in the house.
Died.
But his manifesto was a compelling document.
I never did read that.
Oh, yeah. I cited it in last year's or maybe the year before's year in review. And he wrote about all the people in the LAPD, and he said, this guy's good, this guy's bad, this guy's corrupt, this guy steals stuff, this guy does drugs, this guy. He itemized his way through the LAPD. But what was striking, and then he declared war and ended up dead, right? But what was striking was when you read his manifesto, he was not a loner. He was not isolated. He had friends. There was meaning in his life. And he just decided he had a calling.
That's interesting.
It's an amazing story, actually.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, I'm sure that I didn't pay enough attention. Of course, the media can't memory hole something like that fast enough.
Right.
We need him to be a crazy terrorist of some kind, loner. That's what we need in our story set. And so this view from Mount Stupid, it's been an incredible view. And I think for 2016, but I've been saying this every year for three, but I really think that we're closer to the day when we have to sort of deal with the consequences of our actions. And I meant that our broadly, the Federal Reserve's actions. I really think, though, that 2016, it would really surprise me if we escape without getting into some really hairy market correction territory. What do you think?
So I went to an investment conference in Vegas, which I go to. I go to this conference each year with the Stansberry Group and give a talk. And Porter Stansberry, who I think is a genius, he's a funny guy, and he's got a bad rep out there. Someone hung a bad rep on him, but I think he's really smart. He says that in 2017 the emerging market debt rollover is going to max out, and so I saw the plots, I saw the slides, and it was a compelling story. So when the emerging market debt market goes down for the count, And they start rolling over and insolvency starts showing up big time, then I think so that could be the trigger. That could be like FASB 157, when I think that was the trigger for the mortgage market, was the legalized, the accounting rules they put into place. All of a sudden the MBS world fell apart. I think the emerging market rolling over in earnest we'll do it, and we're not even there yet. That's the irony, and I think it's rolling over now, but we haven't hit the peak rollover. Remember that iconic plot of the mortgage resets that got posted 10,000 times on the internet by Credit Suisse? Yeah, there's got to be an analogous one for emerging market debt out there somewhere. I've been able to find it, but it's got to be out there somewhere.
There's two things I've been tracking there. One is the sovereign debt loads, but also it's the corporate debt. There's a lot of ink on that. Bloomberg's written pieces, Reuters, et cetera. So you could easily find out what the numbers are. It's really astonishing the amount of new debt that got taken on in the last 5 or 6 years is some astonishing number, like $4 or $5 trillion, all dollar denominated, which, of course, think about it from Mexico's standpoint, with the peso hitting, brand new all-time lows, or the Brazilian real, or South Africa. It's just stunning. So with bubbles this big, all bubbles are in search of a pin. I think that absolutely emerging market debt is a pin. Is it the longest pin out there? It might be.
And the other thing, someone said how bad off, I can't remember, the asset class was going to be if there were a recession right now, and it struck me that it's the very existence of that risk that probably brings in the recession at some level, right? And so it's the top heaviness of the credit system. Corporate debt is not only huge, and you hear about all the corporate cash in the balance sheet. Every year I try to go with that. They got a lot of cash on the balance sheet. They got way more debt, right? I mean, that's like saying I got 100K in the bank and 500K on my credit card. I'm rich because I got 100K, right? It just doesn't make sense. And they've been using it to buy back shares and kind of LBOs so that the creditors are buying up the companies, essentially. And it's some and corporate earning profit margins have hit all-time highs, and they're serious mean regressing things. Profit margins don't stay at all-time highs for long. And so all of a sudden, the profit margins will shrink, the PEs will soar, and of course, they stop buying back stocks when things go to hell. And the support underneath the buybacks is going to go away. So, I just don't see how this thing doesn't unravel in some stupendous sort of way that I hope I'm out of the splash zone.
Well, you and me both. And I guess we'll just have to stay in touch, because I do have a buy list of things I am interested in owning. And I'm going to be as patient as I know how to be on all of this. But I haven't found anything compelling to invest on the long side in a while, except for silver. I have bought silver in the past year, and I bought a little more gold a little while ago. But that's just sort of nibbling, and it's only to make me feel like I have some sense of purpose in life, doing something.
I bought gold all year for the first time since 2005. So once I got to 2005, I said, okay, I got enough gold. And then I was feeling very rich in 2011. And then I got beat up, and I finally started buying again. It hasn't made me look terribly smart yet. Although it's up fourfold. Are you buying miners?
No, not yet.
I tell you, their inability to make money is epic. I got to talk to the CEO of Seabridge Mining, and he said that the entire industry is filled with disasters, and he might be one too, for all I know. But I have the terrible time buying a gold miner, because they had gold running at $1,900 an ounce, and they couldn't make money. And if you can't make money at $1,900 an ounce, you are in the wrong business.
Well, that's why I avoided all the shale players back when they weren't making money at oil at $100. If you didn't like him at 100, you're going to hate him at 35. So,
well, I blew that one. I blew that one. I held on. I've been white knuckling it all the way down again. They did well for years, but my bottom low. But I know
it was the negative free cash flow that bothered me. So they were basically spending, even at the peak of it all in 2014, before things rolled, they were spending $1.50 in CapEx to get $1 of new revenue. And I hate business models like that, particularly when your shale wells deplete 85% in 3 years and you've been at it 5 years. You should be hitting some sort of steady state somewhere in there, where your CapEx out and your cash flow in are balancing out and it makes money. I didn't see it. So that bothered me.
A bright side to that story is, about a year and a half ago, I went to University of Montana, Montana State. Now, both schools, my colleagues in chemistry were bitching about the fact that the state was just hoarding their revenues and not spending it. They thought that was wrong. And I said, yeah. And I kept saying, are you sure? Because, you know, governments that don't spend money are pretty rare and pretty special. And I bet you right about now, they're going, you know, not spending all that money is looking pretty sound right about now. Now, Alaska supposedly gets 90% of its revenues from oil. Wrap your brain around that one.
Well, they're going to have an income tax for the first time this year.
Yeah, and they're going to, as I said in the year in review, I said they can see bankruptcy from their front porch.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
I love the front porch metaphor now. I'll put anyone on a front porch.
Think about the whiplash those poor people in Alaska have, those guys out in their cabins with their big beards, you know, they got a grizzly out back, and they've been getting these checks every year, and instead of a check, they get a bill. That's a big turnaround.
I know. There's a lot of rude awakenings coming, and it's going to be painful. And the youngsters, the 20 somethings in the job market, are getting paid squat. And now we're about to hit a downturn, right? So here you are earning nothing or unemployed, and now we're going to hit a downturn. And you could say, oh, why are we going to get a downturn? Because we always get a downturn, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, spring follows winter, right? You always get downturns. And the next one is coming off of a meta-stable upturn, right? It's just the whole thing feels wrong. The narrative is wrong. The plot line is wrong. And the only thing that's right is that they were able to pump assets. That's the only storyline this whole thing is based on. And even that I go at in the year in review, where I talk about the farm. I there's a farm metaphor where I point out that the Fed seems to think if they can jack up the price of the farm, they will jack up the output. And there's not a shred of evidence that jacking up the assessed value of the farm jacks up the output. And if you don't jack up the output, you're still putting out bushels of wheat, you're still putting out cows, you're still putting out milk. And if somehow you sell the farm to someone else just got a horrendous deal buying the farm. You haven't increased anything. You've just increased the price.
Well, you know, that's going to be a hard sort of a thing for somebody like Bernanke to understand, or Yellen, both of whom haven't spent a lot of time running businesses. They've never owned a farm, so I think your metaphor is completely lost on them. That's probably not going to work out. You'll have to come up with another one, maybe using textbooks, I don't know. But at least, you know, I know you've got one good read on your shelf, The Courage to Act. It's going to be amazing. I hope you read it, because I'm never going to, so I need you to tell me what's in there.
No, I'm not reading it.
I can't bring myself to do it. I just can't. I can't.
I've heard it's bad, too. I could read it if someone said, you know, it's a nice story or whatever. And he made a mistake writing it, by the way, because he had been able to keep himself shrouded in mystery. And then all of a sudden he comes out and tells what he was thinking. You go, oh, really? Are you kidding me? That's what was going on in your skull? So I think he put blogger porn out there on the internet for everybody. And I think he should have shut his mouth and been inscrutable.
Like George W. Bush, like where'd he go? Nobody knows. He's out painting or something. He just disappeared. Nobody wants to hear him speak, and that's fine. You know, that's
right. That's it's looking pretty good right about now.
Well, all right. Well, obviously I could talk to you forever. You know, we should do this again. I don't know if we have to wait to have a year in review to have a podcast, because you and I could just go on and on and on any one of these areas. And of course, this is going to be a fascinating year. I'm reasonably convinced there's going to be a military accident somewhere in the Middle East. I'm reasonably convinced there's a financial accident coming. I think Europe's straining and looking like it wants to burst apart for a whole host of extraordinarily good reasons. Japan, who knows? That's just a slow motion disaster going on there, all sorts of ways. So lots to talk about, and I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, hopefully by then we'll be able to see the consequences of the Syrian refugee crisis, because I think that might be the story of the year. And I don't think the consequence, you got 1.5 million Syrians inside Germany, and it's not cold yet.
Yeah, I was sitting next to a woman at a dinner. Her husband's at the UN. She's a reasonably well-known newscaster in her country. She's from Serbia. And she almost went to tears. This was a nice dinner. And I was like, if you don't want to talk about this, please just forget I ever asked this. But, you know, do you have, would you be willing to talk to me? Like, what's going on with the refugees? She immediately wanted to talk about it, almost in tears, just saying when she was last back in Belgrade, she did not recognize it at all, because her beautiful city, small, very small country, not that many people. And she said every street corner had 4 or 5 20-something-year-old Syrian men on the corner who had nothing else to do, and she didn't feel safe, and the culture was off. They'd been overrun in some way, and she was very, very upset about it. And it was a cultural sort of an insult. It was a, what are we going to do practically? How do these people integrate? They don't want to. You know, Brussels is telling us we have to take these people. Brussels is providing no money, but a lot of threats, and on and on and on it went. So it was obviously a very important flashpoint. And I understood what she was talking about. I live in a town of 2000, and there was some towns we've heard about that of the same size as mine that have that many refugees housed in them now. I think that would be a little bit troubling, to be honest, for me personally.
Well, for you and I, the equivalent might be if, you know, we had one of these horrific downturns and, you know, New York City emptied up into upstate New York, right? Upstate Connecticut. And all of a sudden you could find yourself living in a town full of people who, you know, it's one thing when it's an immigration where the person says, look, I wish to be in the United States, or I wish to be in Germany. It's another thing when they just flush out of there. I've been trying to figure out what the density of young male really is, because some of it could be propaganda. But if it's really all 20-something males, there's nothing more dangerous than a group of 20-something males from any culture. That's a dangerous group. And if literally, you know, many, many millions of 20-something males from a culture that doesn't really agree with Western Europe had flooded in, that's not Ellis Island. That's a very different situation.
Well, yeah, and not just males who flooded in, but they flooded in from the same country that maybe you bombed. right?
Yeah, that's really a very touchy little detail, isn't it?
Kind of a touchy detail there. Just a thing. It's a little thing there.
Just a touch.
Because, you know, I also have a vengeance setting on my dial, but if you basically bombed my country and hurt my family, you have a problem on your hands.
I'd be getting even. I just stated that before. If I were in one of those countries, I'd have terrorists written on my forehead, I think.
Well, and it's so human, and it's understandable, of course, and that the West seems incapable of understanding, you know, that the people don't appreciate our fine attempts to transform their country using Raytheon hardware. It's just such a tone deaf moment of Western journalism. It's astonishing. But here we are. And I think that's going to be a flashpoint potential. It's just one of many, many pins I see out there that could burst our current illusion of prosperity. So with that, yeah, let's do this again sometime soon.
Sounds good.